different equity-seeking groups that have spaces here, and they're all saying, wow, this is really important. Each group, so whether it's the Women's Center or SOCA or whatever, they have their members talking about their work situations, asking for advice, and they all have stated to Steph and I, we would love to have a place to say, hey, why don't you go here? And it's not, we're not going to be a legal clinic, but it would be a place where we're way more prepared to answer questions about employment, but also to do workshops and also activism around class and work issues than all the other spaces, because their plates are already full.
Yeah, maybe I'll just add that, like, as a TA in labor studies and in sociology, actually, we have several assignments where people write about their jobs. And I would love to be able to be like, wow, your job sounds really exploitative.
Yeah.
You know, from like a teaching standpoint, yeah. You know, just not only am I evaluating the quality of their work, I'm also like, they're being vulnerable with their experiences, and I would like to be able to like care for that, like from the perspective of like an instructor or like a TA, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think something like that is a way for even instructors to direct their students if like these vulnerabilities are coming out in their assignments.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, like of course there are these other equity seeking groups on campus that can support students, but like from my experience in TAing in sociology and in labor studies, it would just be a fantastic way to make the university a more like fulsome, practical, like experience for students, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do want to say the response from the few senior administrators I've met with has also been really positive.
Okay, I wanted to ask you
that. Which was, I was going to say surprising, and so I misjudged these people that I was talking to who had the positive response and thought this was a really great idea. I went in thinking it was going to be a different experience, and I was pleasantly surprised. So that was good. A lot of the folks who we've interacted with and talked with have really stressed it from their own lived experience. International students in particular have talked about how if only this existed 2 years ago, 3 years ago, or for, you know, international grad students saying, this would have been really good that first year when I came over here and took that job under the table that was paying me $5 an hour and I had no idea. So that's a really poignant reminder about how super exploited international students are, both by our university asking for three times the tuition fees from international students and by shady employers in our broader community who are exploiting international students' vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. Like, and vulnerabilities, I mean like visa requirements, mm-hmm. work requirements, lack of knowledge of the Canadian labor and BC labor codes and systems.
A lot of wage theft.
Yeah, a lot of wage theft. And just simply underpaying and breaking minimum employment standards, that stuff.
Mm-hmm. It seems like a big portion of the largest part of the resource initiative is filling that knowledge gap, giving students the ability to advocate for themselves that they may not have had otherwise, because even if something is against, just fully against the labor code transparently, like you said, a lot of these employers kind of bank on the fact that their employee may not have the awareness of it in the first place.
Yeah, totally. Steph and I are both nodding, but I realize that nodding doesn't come across well on radio or podcast. Yes, exactly, Danny. And the way in which we can't anticipate how powerful it will be for people to, particularly undergraduate students, let's say, to be in a room together, share their experience, and then they decide what could we do about this with, you know, the director helping them. It goes back to your question of what do we envision in this space. That's the stuff we can't know. But in every experience I've had, you know, as a student very decades ago, all the spaces on campus, like the student newspaper, the radio station, the PIRG, were all empowering spaces for not just whatever the person who created the radio station thought it was going to be, but for what the people who came and populated it and volunteered there, what they made it. And I'm excited to see that. But we realized we had to take these baby steps of, like, let's secure space and let's get funding. And we're getting a lot of traction for the idea. But I do want to stress at this point, it is still an initiative. Like, we are working towards this goal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Are there any initiatives, like, similar to this in other universities that you were able to sort of model off of?
Yeah, there aren't a lot. There are some in the United States of America that are broader workers' centers. So they, and then there's student solidarity center. There's a handful in the U.S. and there are things in Canada that kind of look like what we're doing, but they're larger initiatives that don't just do worker advocacy stuff. So they have committees. They'll have, like, a student worker committee. The closest thing is, in terms of analogies, is PIRG, but solely about class and workers and student workers. All the different groups, SOCA, Women's Center, those are really the best models for us, but with our very specific class-based orientation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's not a lot of student worker centers out there. And if you Google student worker center, so I did find some examples, but a lot of what comes up, unfortunately, are employment centers.
Mm.
And student workers and...
like recruitment centers.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
One thing that's important to emphasize about the Student Worker Center is that, like, we don't have any relationship to anybody's employer.
Yes.
So, you know, even if you're a worker and you go to your union has a relationship to the employer. What the quality of that relationship is varies from union to union. But with the Student Worker Center, it is really a place for political education and empowerment and class consciousness,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of students, like, they come to school and we're all, like, class neutral,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, you can't tell who has, you know, a lot of material support to do their studies and get good grades and, like, get the awards and, like, the credentials and then go on to, like, you know, they have class mobility, right? And that's really something that's quite absent from even, like, classes where we're, like, reading, like, critical theory or whatever or what have you. I don't know what it's like in the sciences, but... Yeah, so I think it's like when people come to the Student Worker Center, ideally, you know, they're talking about their working conditions and they're able to meet other people who share those experiences, and that's a kind of class solidarity, even if we're not, like, you know, advertising that, right? So it's the kind of sociality that I think is really missing from, you know, like, SFU.
And it's, yeah, absolutely, Steph. And what I'm hearing you say, it's missing... Yeah. At universities and colleges, but particularly universities, where when we started this interview, we talked about, like, what this is and how the idea came about. And it really is that there's a place for everybody's lived experience at university as students, but not as workers. The university itself doesn't want to recognize class. Like what I heard Steph say, there's this, like, assumed class neutrality. Which, and this will take me off on way too much of a tangent, is a problem with Canadian society as a whole. We're all taught sort of de facto that we're all middle class, which is ridiculous. It's like, okay, and when you get down to it, what's middle class? Oh, it's if you have a home or if you can afford cable or you have a car. And it's like, okay, you're just talking about things. Like, it's not about the fact that a majority of Canadians are working class. Over 60% of Canadians are working class in terms of their income, but also power and agency in their lives and in their workplace. there's a small section of middle class, and then we have the capitalist class. But we're kind of taught, well, we're not taught about class. So everyone just assumes you're middle class. And in the classroom, if I have a student that's speaking up about their terrible working conditions, somebody else can put up their hand and say, oh, well, I don't experience that. And then go on to negate that student's lived working class or working poor experience. And as the instructor, I have to navigate that, right? I don't just shut the middle class or student whose parents are capitalists. I can't shut them down. But at a student worker center, that same student, like I could even say after class, like, hey, you might want to check this space out. And then they go and talk about their lived experience and other people like, yeah, man, mm-hmm. I experienced the exact same thing. So Student Worker Center can create solidarity amongst, we know, like when I was going to school, undergraduate, graduate, I knew that I was different from the students that had a lot of money whose parents bought, I went to UVic for my undergrad. There were students whose parents bought condominiums, and this is in the 90s, so they must have made a killing on them later. Wow, in the 90s. I can't believe I just said that. Holy. Anyway, and their whole lives were completely different than mine. And we knew we were working class, but a lot of us didn't find each other because there was this assumed sort of middle class, like, oh, well, don't talk about that. And it's like, well, why not?
I think those were the main questions I had for this interview. If there was anything, though, that we didn't touch on that you want to mention that you think people should know about, what would that be?
I think that this is really exciting. Everybody we've talked to has been excited about this and sees the need. So that's really encouraging for us, I think, for our team.
Yeah, our team. Our team of two.
Once again, that was our conversation with Steph Ling and John Henry Harder, who are currently working together on the Student Worker Center initiative at SFU, which aims to provide a space for SFU students to get information on their rights as workers. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started, so I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.
Sled Island Music and Arts Festival is back June 17th to 21st, presented by Service Credit Union. Experience 5 days of music, comedy, art, and much more in diverse venues across Calgary, Alberta. Joining Sled Island's previously announced guest curator, Clipping, is English Chamber Folk Ensemble, Black Country New Road, revered Canadian pop project Homeshake, renowned abstract rapper Billy Woods, LA synth punk's Sextile, fuzzy indie rock outfit Feeble Little Horse, outlandish egg punk group Snooper, lo-fi post-punk duo Sweeping Promises, New York City-based ambient pioneer Laraji, genre-bending dream pop artist Salami Rose Joe Lewis, and many more. Plus, there are over 150 more artists still to be announced. Check out the current lineup and get your passes and tickets at sledisland.com.
Hello, 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 and welcome back to to Intravenous. You've been tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, broadcasting from the unceded Coast Salish territories. I have another interview that I want to share with you. This is an interview that I actually did Monday, I believe it was. And one of the things that I do love about recording remotely is that I do sometimes have the opportunity to record outside. So if you do hear any birds or anything of that nature, I hope you enjoy the background vibes. My conversation is with Jordan Wilson, Museum of Anthropology exhibition curator, and we chatted about the exhibition I Use My Haida Eyes, and this is being featured at MOA starting today, and it goes all the way until October, so there is plenty of time to check this out. Let's take a listen. This is Nicole Hines with CJSF 90.1 FM, and I'm here with Jordan Wilson, Museum of Anthropology exhibition curator. And we're going to chat about the exhibition I Use My Haida Eyes that is being featured at MOA starting on May 14th. Thank you for joining me today, Jordan. How are you?
Excited. The show's opening in just a couple days, and I was out of town the last week, so I'm... Yeah, very excited to see how the installation's looking.
Awesome. So I would love if you could share, tell us more about the exhibition, I Use My Haida Eyes, the History Robes of Jukine Hazel Wilson, just so that our listeners can get a better understanding.
Sure. So Hazel Wilson was a late Haida artist. She was born in Masset on Haida Gwaii and was the mother of 10 children. She, from a very young age, was tasked by her grandmother and elders of her family with the responsibility of making button blankets, what are commonly referred to as button blankets, which are a type of ceremonial garment. Typically on melton wool cloth, and typically depicting an individual's clan crest imagery or their family's crest imagery. And in the early 2000s, the late Hazel Wilson started to innovate on that form, expand on that form, by moving away from depicting abstract crest imagery towards a more representational form, a narrative form, in terms of depicting her own childhood experiences, as well as the oral history that was passed down to her. So this exhibition is presenting a series of what have been termed history robes that are presenting, like I said, Haida history that's both of her lived experience, but also what was passed down to her. And from around 2005 to 2006, she made 51 of these robes. They each are about 5 by 6 feet, so they're not small. And she made 51 of them, and it's a pretty incredible body of work. For a few reasons, yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. And have you seen all the pieces in the space as of yet? Because I can imagine that that's pretty powerful.
No, I think I just stepped back into the museum. I was on I was away last week. No, but they've never been presented as a whole series before.
Okay.
I've spent time with each individual robe, going through them one by one, and that was an experience I had when I was researching for a different exhibit a number of years ago. Was encountering this body of work and going through them one by one, and it just kind of blew me away. I just found that these robes were just awe-inspiring, and I've been really excited about the fact that they'll be all hung together in the same space and really bring you into Hazel's world. And that's in part where we developed the exhibition title, I Use My Haida Eyes, because you're, you know, in many ways, you're seeing the world through late Hazel's eyes. And that's a quote that she, a quote from one of the stories that she tells, where she talks about going into thrift stores and, you know, looking for materials that could be repurposed for these robes. So I guess I should describe that, you know, these robes are, you know, mostly using appliqué as a technique to create imagery, but she was also using acrylic paint. Oh. And in terms of the appliqué, she was, you know, using a whole range of materials in terms of different types of textiles, but then also beads and buttons and shells. So they're quite rich in their materials, and she would, yeah, like I said, go into like thrift stores and find shirts that had old mother of pearl buttons on them that she could reuse, and look for old Hudson's Bay blankets and other textiles that she could use for her projects. And so this notion of using her Haida eyes was about like a certain type of resourcefulness in her art making. And I guess the other thing I've yet to mention is that for each of these 51 robes, she wrote out by hand the narrative that she's depicting on lined foolscap paper. So she, you know, tells these stories in her own voice, and often is really, you know, if directly addressing the reader or the viewer of the work. And she really imagined these robes as taking her place as a storyteller and directly addressing people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes this body of work really interesting, is that she was, you know, making these robes and depicting these stories and documenting these stories for her children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. But then, you know, she was also well aware that that they could reach a broader audience as well beyond her own family. So it's this thing where she's both transmitting cultural knowledge and history to her future descendants, but then also addressing a non-Haida public.
Absolutely. And I'm curious, like, how long did this exhibition take to come together?
I think this maybe a little bit under a year.
Okay.
I just stepped into this position in March of last year, and there was essentially a gap in the exhibition schedule for this year, and I'd kind of mentioned offhand wanting to pursue a project with this body of work, and it all just kind of lined up. The other, you know, super important thing or helpful thing is that back in 2022, there was this publication that was published through the Haida Gwaii Museum and Figure One Press in collaboration with Hazel Wilson's family. And it shares all of these robes and their stories and her life history. But the interesting thing is that there wasn't an accompanying exhibition at the time. So, as I mentioned, these have yet to be shown in a gallery setting in their entirety. And so I'm excited about that. And having this book as a resource was incredibly helpful in terms of contextualizing Hazel's life and her work. And over the last year, I've also been very privileged to spend time with two of Hazel's daughters, Dana Simeon and Avis Simeon, who spent a lot of time with their mom when she was working on these robes. And late Hazel had, you know, spent her life making button blankets and Chilkat style robes and performing Haida songs and storytelling for audiences all over North America. And Dana and Avis often accompanied her as children for these and participated in these performances. So they were very helpful and supportive in the development of this exhibition over the last year and sharing stories about their mom, who I never had the privilege of meeting. So yeah, so that's kind of how this project came together.
Yes, absolutely. And so opening night is May 14th, so just literally around the corner. It is at the Museum of Anthropology at UBC. The opening night starts at about 6 o'clock, right? And goes to maybe about 8 or so, and it is free to the public, so that is a special night. But there is also going to be a special tour, I guess, for like the opening weekend, starting on, I guess, the 16th, the Saturday. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So for the opening weekend, I'll be offering two curatorial tours on Saturday, May 16th, one at 11 a.m. and another at 1:30 p.m. So you can come join me and learn about the exhibition and learn about Hazel Wilson and join me for a conversation. So I'm really looking forward to being able to share this very important work with the public.
Absolutely. I think I had a few questions that I was going to ask, but you literally kind of shared a bit of your excitement and, you know, why we should come. I think that there's a lot to learn about Hazel, and just to see, I'm really excited to see the pieces in it, like in its entirety, like, you know what I mean? Pretty much close to the set. I think there's just missing one, is it? Or yeah. So there's 50 out of the 51, but that's incredible. Like that is pretty, I think incredible to see, and the energy, I'm sure. Plus with her hand written, you know, notes.
Yeah.
per piece. So I'm excited about that. Before I let you go, I'm curious, like, is there anything that you want to share in addition to what you've already shared so far to, you know, I want to get folks coming out to visit?
I think, you know, I briefly touched on this, but the stories themselves are quite diverse, and they're really kind of hard to categorize in terms of like their genre or their time period even. Hazel herself never sequenced the robes, so they weren't they aren't necessarily presented in like a chronological order. But there, I think there will be something for everyone. You know, as I was saying, like she was writing both for her family but also for a broader audience, and I think there's a lot of really valuable lessons and teachings in her robes in terms of Haida ways of doing things and relating to a Haida landscape. But at their core, it's like, I think, about a divergence between indigenous values and settler values. And so I think they have a lot to offer in terms of thinking through where we find ourselves today and where we're going. So that part excites me, is, you know, what kind of discussion will these robes generate. And I also think that there's a playfulness to some of them too, so I think they'll be appealing to different ages and audiences for different reasons.
And that was my conversation with Jordan Wilson. I just want to thank you so much for joining me today. We are going to get ready for Democracy Now. And I'm just going to play us out with a track called Rust and Wire.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m.